12. Floyd continued his tour of the building in Rue des Peupliers, knocking on doors and sometimes getting an answer. He worked methodically and patiently, turning on the charm when it was required. By the end of his inquiries, it was clear that at least two other tenants had seen the girl in the building, hanging around on the stairs. They couldn't be specific about dates, but the sightings had all occurred within the last 3 or 4 weeks, consistent with there being a link to the White case. Once observed, the girl was not usually seen again by the same witness. Another tenant might have seen an odd child in the street outside, but he was insistent that this child had been a boy rather than a girl. Floyd and Christine had seen a strange girl leaving the Blanchard building the evening before, and Floyd had noticed what he thought was a different girl watching White's window from outside earlier that day. Floyd still hadn't spoken to the witness on the second floor, the one who had mentioned a child to Christine the night before. Floyd had no idea what to make of it all. Strange little children hadn't figured prominently in any of his previous investigations. Perhaps he was latching on to any anomaly in the hope that it might break open the case. Maybe if he visited any similar apartment building in the city and asked a similar set of questions, he'd get a similar set of responses. He was done by 4. He walked back up to Susan White's room and knocked on the door. His shirt was sticky around the collar. All that trudging up and down the stairs was making him sweat. "You get anywhere, Chief?" he asked Christine when he opened the door. Christine let Floyd inside and closed the door. "No, there have been no further transmissions. I removed the back of the wireless again, thinking that one of my connections might have come loose, but all was well. The station is simply not on the air. Maybe they've gone off the air for good." "Perhaps," Christine said. "All the same, I shall try again tomorrow. Perhaps the transmissions only take place at a certain time of day. You can't spend the rest of your life up here. One more day, that's all." Floyd knelt down next to Christine. "Show me what you got before. It's incomplete. I'd like to see it anyway." Christine removed a sheet of paper from the top of the wireless set, on which he'd marked a sequence of dots and dashes in neat pencil. "You can see the pieces I missed," he said. "Of course, there's no guarantee that tomorrow's transmission will be the same as today's, but at least I'll be ready for it tomorrow. I should be able to make an accurate transcription. If you haven't got anything by the middle of the day, we close this line of inquiry. There is something going on here, whether you like it or not. Maybe there is, but we can't waste Blanchard's money just sitting around waiting for a transmission that may never return. There are other leads that need to be followed up. Generated by the material Greta examined? That and something else." Quickly he told Christine about the paperwork in the tin and what Greta made of it. "There's a Berlin connection, some kind of heavy manufacturing contract, and what looks like a sketch of a blueprint. For what? Haven't figured that out yet, but whatever it is, there are 3 of them. I hope you got more detail than that." "3 large aluminium castings," Floyd said. "Big, solid spheres." "How big is big? I might be misreading the sketch, but it looks to me as if these things are at least 3 meters in diameter." "Big," Christine agreed. "Looks like they're meant to be suspended from something, like a kind of gallows. One sphere gets shipped to Paris, another to Milan, while the 3rd stays in Berlin." "Perplexing," Christine said, stroking his mustache. "What would this American girl have been doing involved with a contract like that?" "Greta and I talked about that. We figured that maybe it wasn't her contract at all, but one that she was taking an interest in for some reason. Back to the spy theory, in other words." "Sorry," Floyd said, "but all roads really do keep leading to Rome. Where are you going to take things now? Did the box offer any other leads?" "We have the address and telephone number of the metalworks in Berlin." "Have you called it yet?" "No, but I plan on doing so as soon as I get back to the office." "Be careful, Floyd. If there is an espionage connection, poking your nose into things might not be your wisest move. And what do you think you've been doing all afternoon?" "That's different," Christine said dismissively. "All I'm doing is trying to intercept the wireless transmission." "And no one would be able to tell that you're doing that?" "Of course not," Christine answered, but not with complete confidence. "Look, I'll spend one more morning on this. Then I'll put the wireless back exactly the way I found it and move on." "I'm just saying." "I know, and I understand. I think we've both convinced ourselves that there's more to this than meets the eye, haven't we? I guess Blanchard was right all along, Floyd said, standing and stretching his legs. Have you spoken to him again today? Not yet, but I intend to. I figure I need to tell him that we're at least making a kind of progress. You mentioned another lead. Floyd shuffled his feet awkwardly. Look, don't think me a fool, but I've noticed that strange little girl keeps showing up in this case. There was that girl we saw. I know, Christine said, waving his hand, and the girl that the tenant on the second floor mentioned, and the girl you saw standing outside. Peripheral details, Floyd. No more than that. How can you be certain? I'm certain of nothing, but the one thing my years at the K taught me is that small children tend not to be prime suspects in murder cases. Maybe this isn't your usual homicide case, Floyd said. Are you seriously proposing that a child murdered Susan White? If she was standing by the balcony rail, Floyd said, it wouldn't have taken much of a shove to send her over. You don't need much strength for that. If her position was that precarious to begin with, it's entirely possible that she just lost her balance. Andre, you know as well as I do that she was pushed. I'm merely playing devil's advocate, Floyd. Even if you can present a case to the K, the examining magistrate will still have to be convinced before the police will take matters further. Christine took the paper upon which he had recorded the wireless transmissions and folded it twice before slipping it into his shirt pocket. And there's another problem with your child as murderer hypothesis, which is, we know that whoever murdered Susan White sabotaged this wireless. Quite aside from the effort required to pull off the backing panel, they would also have needed the strength to drag the wireless away from the wall and then slide it back again. You managed it on your own? I had plenty of time, Christine said. There's also the small detail that I am not a child. I can't judge exactly how much effort was required, but I doubt that it was within the ability of a little girl. Then she had an adult accomplice. In which case, Christine said patiently, we may as well assume that the adult accomplice was the murderer. I still think there's something significant about these children. Floyd, you know I have the utmost respect for you, but another valuable lesson I took away from my time at the K, back when solving crimes was its chief activity, rather than harassing enemies of the state, is that it is just as important to ignore certain details in a case as it is to follow up on others. You're saying I'm barking up the wrong tree. The wrong tree, the wrong corpse, perhaps even the wrong area of forestation entirely. I'm reluctant to rule anything out. Good, rule nothing out, but don't be distracted by ridiculous theories, Floyd. Not when we already have concrete leads. Floyd sighed, a moment of clarity intruding upon his thoughts. Christine was right, of course. Now and then, Floyd had a habit of pursuing blatantly unlikely lines of inquiry. Sometimes, even if all they were investigating was a minor case of spousal infidelity, they led to a critical breakthrough. More often than not, however, he needed a gentle reminder from Christine to return to the orthodox approach, and more often than not, Christine's stolid, honed scientific methods turned out to be exactly what the case required. This, Floyd realized, was exactly one of those times. You're right, he said. If only one of those strange kids had shown up, I guess I'd have thought nothing of it. The central defect of the human mind, Christine said, is its unfortunate habit of seeing patterns where none exist. Of course, that is also its chief asset, but sometimes a very dangerous one. Christine stood up, wiping his palms on his trousers. Don't feel bad about it, Floyd. It happens to the best of us, and there's never any harm in asking questions. Christine gathered his tools, hat, and coat, and together they walked down two flights of stairs and knocked on Blanchard's door. Floyd delivered a sanitized version of events. Yes, it seemed likely to him that Susan White had been murdered. It even seemed likely to him that she had been something other than an innocent American tourist. A spy? Blanchard asked. Too soon to say, Floyd answered. There are still leads we need to look into, but you'll hear from us as soon as we have something concrete. I spoke to one of the other tenants. It seems you have been asking questions about that little girl. Just ruling out any possible witnesses, Floyd said. What could a little girl possibly have to do with this? Probably nothing at all, Christine interjected, before Floyd was tempted to expound his unlikely theories to Blanchard.
Very well,
Blanchard said, eyeing the two of them. I must emphasize how important it is to me that you find Suzanne's killer. I fear that she will not sleep soundly until the matter is resolved. He said it as if he meant Susan White, but he was looking at the photograph of his dead wife. They drove back through thick Thursday afternoon traffic, taking Avenue de Choisy north to Place d'Italie, and then cutting through a darkening rat's maze of side streets until they were on Boulevard Raspail. Floyd turned the radio dial, searching for jazz, but all he got was traditional French accordion music. It was the new thing now. Traditional was in, jazz out. Chatelier himself had called jazz morally corrupting, as if the music itself was a kind of narcotic that had to be wiped from the streets. Accordion music always made Floyd feel seasick. He turned off the wireless. There's something I need to ask, Christine said.
Say it.
There's a possibility we haven't really discussed. It concerns the old man.
Go on.
Do you think it's possible he killed her? Floyd thought about it for a moment, then shook his head.
Makes no sense, Andre. If the police weren't interested, why would he risk reopening that can of worms?
Human nature being what it is, anything's possible. What if he has a secret need to be discovered? Once the police abandoned their inquiry, he'd have had no choice but to call in private detectives. All the evidence we've seen so far points away from Blanchard. But we know he had access to her rooms. He's the one person who has keys for every room. What if she did have a lover, and Blanchard found out about it? Explain the wireless, or the smashed typewriter, or the box of papers. Perhaps he's playing some kind of double bluff game with us, strewing our path with misleading clues, while hoping we have the sense to see through them and...
Is this the way they teach you to think at the K?
I'm just saying that we shouldn't exclude the possibility. He seems like a nice enough old gentleman, but the worst ones generally do.
I think you've been sitting in that room for too long, Andre.
Perhaps, Christine said. Still, a little suspicion never goes amiss in this line of work. Floyd turned the car onto Boulevard Saint-Germain. I agree that we can't rule it out, all the other evidence notwithstanding. I'll even admit that the thought had crossed my mind.
Well then.
But I still don't believe he killed her. That said, if you feel you need to explore the possibility, well, I'm sure you can nose around the problem without being too tactless. Ask him again about the police not taking up the case. Ask him if he knew of anyone who might have been jealous of the time he spent with the girl.
I'll be the very model of discretion, Christine said.
You'd better be. If he loses his temper and throws us off the case, we're going to have to start looking for new premises in a less salubrious part of town.
I didn't think there was a less salubrious part of town.
My point exactly, Floyd replied. He parked the Mathis. Nothing new in his pigeonhole, no bills or mysterious letters from long-lost girlfriends. That, he supposed, had to count as a kind of good luck. But the elevator had broken down again, jammed somewhere up on the fourth floor. The engineer from the elevator company was sitting on the lowest flight of stairs, smoking a cigarette and studying the racing pages. He was a small, shrew-like man with pomaded hair, who always smelled of carbolic soap. He nodded at Floyd and Christine as they tramped past.
"Busy, Maurice?" Floyd asked. "Waiting for a new part from head office, Monsieur Floyd."
He shrugged expressively.
"With the traffic the way it is today, could be hours before they get here."
"Don't break a sweat," Floyd said. Maurice saluted them and went back to his newspaper. Entering their office, Christine put away his tools, washed his face and hands, and changed his shirt, and then set about making tea. Floyd sat at his desk, pulling the telephone across and called the Paris operator to request an international call to Berlin. He gave her the number of Caspar Metals, reading from the letter in the tin, and waited for the connection to be made. After a while, the operator's voice came back on again. "I'm sorry, monsieur. That number must be wrong." Floyd gave her the number again, but there had been no mistake.
"You mean no one picks up the telephone?"
"No," she said. "The line is totally dead." Floyd thanked her and returned the receiver to its cradle. One more dead lead, then. He drummed his fingers and then dialed Marguerite's number in Montparnasse.
"Floyd," Greta said, answering.
"How are things?"
"She's resting.
Can I see you this evening?
I suppose so.
Easy on the enthusiasm, kid.
She sighed. I'm sorry, Floyd. It's just that I may not be in the best of moods.
Then you could use some cheering up.
And you're the man for the job, I take it? Christine and I have been working hard on the case. I think we all need a treat tonight. How about I take the three of us out to dinner, and we finish off the evening in Le Perroquet Pourpre?
I suppose I can make it, she said,
not sounding at all sure of herself. Sophie's in tonight, studying, so I could ask her to look after Marguerite.
That's the spirit. I'll drive over in an hour. Spruce yourself up. We're hitting the bright lights tonight.
I'll do my best, she said.
Christine and Floyd drank tea and discussed the case, making sure they'd shared all the essential observations, comparing notes on their interviews with the tenants. While they talked, a scratchy old Bluebird pressing of Sidney Bechet playing Blues in Thirds spun on Floyd's phonograph.
What we're left with, Christine concluded, is an odd American woman who liked to mess around with wirelesses, assuming that she did that and not some previous tenant.
We're left with a bit more than that, Floyd said. We know she had an odd interest in a manufacturing contract in Berlin. We know that when she died, her typewriter died with her. We know she had a habit of accumulating books and things.
Unusual observations, collectively, but all perfectly explicable in and of themselves. But taken together, not enough to make a convincing case that she was a spy.
What about the children?
Christine gave Floyd a reproving look. I was rather hoping you wouldn't mention the children again. I still never got to speak to the one tenant who had a really good look at the girl. I'll visit him again tomorrow, if it will make you happy. In the meantime, might I suggest that we restrict ourselves to firm leads?
Floyd thought for a moment, his mind adrift on the rise and fall of Bechet's saxophone. The disc was scratched and ancient, the music almost buried in a surf of hisses and clicks. He could have replaced it with a cheap bootleg tomorrow, and the sound would have been as clear and clean as a tin whistle, but it wouldn't have been the right kind of clarity. The knockoff might have fooled 99 people out of 100, but there was something raw and truthful engraved into this damaged old shellac, something that cut through the noise and 30 years like a clarion.
The Berlin connection's a dead end, he said, and we don't know what she was doing with the books and magazines.
And records, Christine reminded him, except of course that we have Monsieur Blanchard's sighting of her entering Cardinal Lemoine metro station with a loaded suitcase, and her subsequent reappearance with an empty one, as if she'd exchanged the contents with another spy.
Precisely, but again it's circumstantial. She could just as easily have handed the contents to a shipping agent.
This is the bit that doesn't make sense, Floyd said. He anticipated the record sticking on a particular phrase, timing the stamp of his foot against the floorboards to coax the needle into the next groove. He did it so expertly that the jump was barely audible. Whether or not it would ever stand up in court, we have more than enough evidence that she was engaged in some kind of espionage activity. But what was she doing with the books and things? Where did they fit in? Part of her cover story as a tourist?
Perhaps, but in that case, why not behave like a respectable tourist instead of some cultural magpie, filling steamer trunk after steamer trunk with all that stuff?
Unless there was something vital buried in all that material, Christine said. It's a pity we don't know what was in the suitcase.
But we know what was left in her room, and there's every reason to believe she would have continued shipping it out if she hadn't been distracted.
And yet nothing we saw looked in any way to be worth the attention of a spy. Books, magazines, newspapers, records, all of which could have been obtained in the United States with varying degrees of difficulty.
There was something about them that mattered to her, Floyd said.
Here's another thing. Silver rain.
Silver rain? Mean anything to you?
I can't say it does.
Susan White made a point of underlining just those words on a postcard she never got round to sending.
Could mean anything.
Could mean nothing at all, Christine said, shrugging.
Sounds like a code word to me. A code word for something unpleasant.
It would, Christine said, smiling at Floyd. But that's because you've got spies on the brain.
There's still the matter of the typewriter.
Well, that's a funny thing. I've been thinking about the typewriter, and there may be more to it than meets the eye. Do you remember Blanchard showing us the box it came in?
He said it was a German model, Floyd said.
Yes, and when he showed us the box and mentioned the name, it made me think of something. The trouble is I can't quite work out how the two are related.
What did it make you think of?
A room in the quay. A windowless cell in the section where the interrogations used to take place, lit by a single electric light. A cell with ceramic tiles on the walls. The kind you can clean easily. The problem is that I can't quite see why there'd be a typewriter in that sort of room.
To take down minutes?
What went on in those rooms, Floyd, was very much not the kind of thing that made it into minutes.
Then why the typewriter?
I don't know. Perhaps I'll remember later, when my mind's on something else.
They said no more as the Bechet record played out, and then for a long while they sat listening to the hiss and scratch of the needle in the run-out groove, as if hoping for a message in the scuffing noise, some whisper of a clue that would crack open the case. Nothing came. Floyd stood up and pulled the needle from the record. They left the office and walked down the stairs, stepping around the elevator engineer who was still sitting there with the racing pages, waiting for his replacement part to crawl across Paris. They drove to Montparnasse, Christine waiting in the Mathis while Floyd fetched Greta. She stepped out into the twilight air, thin and angular in black, like a sketch in Vogue. She wore a black fur stole and a black pillbox hat with a spotted veil, and when she stood under the lamplight, she looked like $1 million, until she was near him, and then she looked tired and sad and on the edge of something she couldn't face.
"Let's go eat," Floyd said gently, "and then let's go hear some real music."
They drove to a little Spanish restaurant Floyd knew on the Quai Saint-Michel. He ordered a good bottle of champagne, a 1926 Veuve Clicquot, waving aside the other's objections that he couldn't possibly afford it. It was true, technically, but Christine had worked hard and Greta deserved a good night out, a chance to forget about Marguerite for a few hours. The food was as good as Floyd remembered, and even the roving guitarist, Greta had to admit, was not as atrocious as some she'd heard. While Floyd settled the bill, Greta and the guitarist talked about tunings and fingerings. The handsome young man in a black shirt offered Greta his guitar, and she played a few tentative notes before shaking her head with an embarrassed smile. The guitarist said something kind in return as he shrugged the guitar strap back over his shoulder. Floyd smiled too. Greta had been holding back, not wanting to blow the kid away. He must have been new in town. After the meal, they drove to Le Perroquet Pourpre, a club on Rue Dauphine. Only a few years ago, there had been 6 or 7 like it in a row, but most of its neighbors were gone now, boarded up or turned into cheap bars with jukeboxes and flickering altar-like television sets in the corner. Le Perroquet was still clinging to business, and was one of the few places still willing to let Floyd and Christine onto the bill without Greta. The walls were covered with photographs of jazzmen, from Jelly Roll and Satchmo through Duke and Beiderbecke, Coleman Hawkins and Django. Some of them had even played on Rue Dauphine. The owner, an amiable bearded Breton called Michel, spotted the three of them entering and waved them over to the bar. He asked Greta how her tour was going, and listened as she told a white lie about leaving the band for a few days while her aunt was unwell. Floyd asked Michel if business was satisfactory, and Michel offered his usual pessimistic shrug, which hadn't changed much in 19 years.
"The young people still have ears for good music," he said. "The trouble is they don't get a chance to hear it anymore. Jazz is political music, always has been, always will be. That's why some people would rather see it dead."
"Maybe they'll get their way," Floyd said.
"Well, you're always welcome here. I just wish I could afford to have you play more often."
"We take what we're given," Floyd said.
"Are you available for the middle Saturday next month? We've just had a cancellation."
"I think we can probably squeeze you in."
"Greta?"
"No,"
she said, lowering eyes already obscured behind the veil.
"I don't think I'll be able to make it."
"Pity. But Floyd and Christine always put on a good show, although perhaps you might consider hiring a temporary piano player."
"We'll think about it," Floyd said.
"Just so long as you keep it nice and melodic, boys, and not so fast that the punters can't tap a toe." He eyed Christine warningly. "None of that difficult 8-beat stuff you keep sneaking in?"
"Maybe the young people want to hear something new for a change," Christine said.
They want something new, not something that sounds like a bull loose in a china shop.
We'll behave ourselves, Floyd assured him, patting Christine consolingly on the arm. Michelle set them up with drinks, beer for Greta and Christine, wine for Floyd, who needed a clear head for the drive back to Montparnasse. Leaning on the bar, occasionally breaking off to serve another customer, Michelle fed them all the latest news on the local music scene. Who was in, who was out, who was hot, who was not, who was sleeping with who. Floyd feigned a polite interest in it all. Although he didn't much care for gossip, it was good to think about something other than the murder case and his own problems for a while. He noticed Christine and Greta starting to laugh more, which made him feel better, and before very long they were all enjoying the company and the music and Michelle's habit of keeping their glasses topped up. At 11 the band came on and stumbled through a dozen swing numbers, big band production stripped down for a four-piece, and while it wasn't the worst thing Floyd had heard, it was a long way from being the best. It didn't matter. He was with his friends. It was snug and smoky down in Le Perroquet. The greats seemed to be looking on benevolently from their photographs on the walls, and for a couple of hours all was right with the world. Skelskad and Auger stooped along a dark, low-ceilinged tunnel of rough-hewn rock, doing their best not to get too filthy in the process. They had eaten and made some further refinements to their outfits. Auger's brand-new handbag bulged with maps and money, some of the latter counterfeit, some of it stolen. They had left the sensor chamber via a heavily armored metal door, accessing a dugout passage that led off in either direction. Skelskad had a torch, a fluted silver thing with a sliding switch, obviously manufactured in E2. Nervously she shone it up and down the shaft, as if half expecting something, then set off to the right. She explained to Auger that excavation work in one direction had been abandoned as soon as the other end of the tunnel intersected an old work shaft put in by the Metco engineers. "Did you tunnel all this out yourselves?" Auger asked. "Most of it. It was easier after we hit the existing works shaft. It must still have been back-breaking work." "It was, until we found we could get an air hose through the sensor. We kept a compressor on our side, and then built a simple pneumatic drill that could be smuggled through as individual components. We reassembled it on this side and supplied it with air via the hose passing through the sensor. That helped a bit, although the sensor had a nasty habit of changing its mind now and then. What about electricity? Can you run that through as well?" "Yes," Skelskad said, "but we never managed to make anything work. Even a torch turned out to be too difficult to break down into simple components. The sensor wouldn't even let an incandescent bulb through in one piece. In the end, we had to run gas through to light lamps, like 19th-century coal miners. It must have been hell. The only thing that kept us going was the rumble of the trains, which told us we were getting nearer to civilization. None of the other exit points have any kind of artificial background noise. At least here, we knew we only had a few dozen meters of earth to tunnel through before we hit the train tunnel. I'm expected to dodge trains now. Only in emergencies. We can trip to power by short-circuiting the electrified rails, but only for short periods. The station's closed now, so the trains aren't running." "Why? What time is it?"
4:30 in the morning on a Friday in October."
"I had no idea."
"Don't worry about it. No one ever does."
Soon they came to a blockage in the tunnel, a tight-fitting wooden door of obvious age. Skelskad shone her torch around the perimeter of the door until she found a concealed handle. She pulled it, groaning with effort. Just when it seemed as though nothing was going to move, the door hinged slowly back towards them. Beyond was another dark tunnel, but this time their voices echoed differently. It was a much larger space and it smelled of sewerage, metallic dust and hot oil. Skelskad's torch gleamed off the 8 parallel lines of polished metal running along the floor, leading off to the left and right. There were 2 sets of parallel railway tracks, with 2 conductor rails for each running line. Skelskad set off to the right, keeping tight against the wall, with Auger following close behind.
"It's not too far to Cardinal Lemoine. Normally, you'd be able to see the station lights from here."
"I'm scared," Auger said. "I'm not sure I can go through with this."
"Scared is good. Scared is just the right attitude."
The station was still dark when they climbed out of the tunnel onto its platform. Wherever Skelskad's torch beam fell,
Auger saw clean ceramic tiles in pale greens and yellows, period signs and advertisements in blocky capitals. Oddly, it didn't feel particularly strange or unreal. She had already visited many buried metro stations under the icebound Paris, and they had often survived more or less intact. It was easy to imagine that this was just another field trip into the city of ghosts. Skelskart showed her to a hiding place and crouched down beside her.
"I know you can do this, Auger. Susan must have known it too, or she wouldn't have lined you up for it."
"I suppose I should be grateful," Auger said doubtfully. "If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be about to see any of this. I hope you like it as much as she did. It was the horses Susan wanted to see."
Horses?
She'd always wanted to know what they were like, as living, breathing things, not some shambling, arthritic reconstruction. "Did she get her wish?"
"Yes," Skelskart said. "I think she did."
The morning rush hour began on cue. From their hiding place, tucked into a gap between two electrical equipment lockers at one end of the platform, Auger watched as the ceiling lights stammered on. She heard the humming of generators powering up, and somewhere the melancholy whistle of a lone worker. She heard a jangle of keys and a slamming of doors. A lull of 10 or 15 minutes followed, and then she watched the early birds begin to assemble on the platform. The electric lighting washed out the colors like a faded photograph, but even taking that into consideration, she was struck by the drabness of the people, the autumnal browns, grays, and greens of their clothes and accessories. Most of the commuters were men. Their faces were sallow, unhealthy-looking. No one was smiling or laughing, and almost no one was talking to anyone else.
"They look like zombies," she said quietly.
"Cut them some slack," Skelskart said. "It's 5 in the morning. A train slid into the station with a tinny squeal of brakes. Doors opened and some of the passengers got on, while others disembarked.
"Now?"
Skelskart put a hand on her shoulder.
"Wait. The next train will have more people on it. You've done this before, I take it. I still get nervous."
After a few minutes, another train arrived, and Skelskart eased them into the flow of exiting passengers. From being detached spectators, they were suddenly in the jostle of a human tide. The smell of the other people hit Auger. Tobacco and cheap aftershave. It wasn't a bad smell, but it instantly made everything more real. In her daydreams, she had often fantasized about drifting through the old city like a ghost, watching but not participating. Her imagination had always neglected to fill in the smell of the city, as if she was viewing things through a sheet of impermeable glass. Now there could be no doubt that she was fully present in the moment, and the shock of it was visceral. She looked at the people around her, measuring herself against them. The clothes she had chosen now felt too sharp and ostentatious. She could not seem to find a natural walking rhythm, or work out what to do with her hands. She kept clutching and then letting go of her handbag.
"Auger," Skelskart hissed, "stop fidgeting."
"I'm sorry."
"Just keep walking ahead and stop worrying. You'll do fine."
The flow of commuters took them up to the street, through a dreary succession of tiled corridors. Auger surrendered her ticket to an uninterested official and stepped into the steely light of early morning. Skelskart steered them away from the metro exit, out of the way of the other commuters. At this time of day, the streets were still relatively empty. Cars and taxis rumbled by occasionally. A white municipal truck potted slowly along the other side of the road, cleaning the curbside with rotating brushes. On either side of the street, balconied buildings rose up 3 or 4 stories. Lights had come on in some of the rooms, and through the curtains and blinds, Auger made out the silhouettes of people preparing for the day.
"It all looks so real," she observed.
"It is real. Get used to it. The moment you start thinking this is some kind of game, some kind of simulation, is the moment it'll give you a bloody nose.
What now?"
"We calm you down. There's a place around the corner that does all-night coffee. You want one?"
"I want to crawl into a corner and suck my thumb."
"You'll get over it. Everyone does. Eventually."
Skelskart led her further from the metro station. They walked down Rue Monge and onto Boulevard Saint-Germain. In the distance, overlapping neon signs formed a scribble of light. They passed a newspaper vendor. More newspapers than Auger had seen in her entire life were just sitting there for the taking. They passed a narrow alley between 2 tenements, in which a man was casually urinating, as if that was his job. A little further on, a heavily made-up woman stood, skirt hitched up to stockinged knee, in a shabby-looking hotel doorway. For an electric instant, the woman and Auger made eye contact. Auger hesitated, some part of her wanting to reach out to the woman and interrogate her about how it felt to be a part of this living tableau. Skelsgård tugged her gently forwards, past a steamed-up basement window, from which some kind of music, brassy and discordant, spilled out into the street.
"I know how you feel," Skelsgård said. "You want to speak to them. You want to test them, find their limits, to know how human they really are and how much they really know. You can't blame me for being curious." "No, I can't. But the less interaction you have with these people, the easier this whole thing will be. In fact, the less you think of them as people, the better. Back there you told me off for saying they looked like zombies. All I'm saying is you need to find a way to maintain a modicum of detachment. Is that how Susan White felt?"
"No," Skelsgård said. "Susan got too close. That was her big mistake."
Skelsgård pushed open the doors of the all-night café. It stood in a row of crumbling directoire period buildings on Boulevard Saint-Germain that hadn't survived the void century.
"Sit here,"
Skelsgård said, directing her to a seat next to the window.
"I'll deal with the coffee. You want milk in it?"
Auger nodded, feeling a weird dizziness. She looked around the room, taking in the other customers, measuring them against herself. Monochrome photographs lined the wall, faint Parisian scenes annotated in neat, inked script. Behind the counter, the staff, hair neatly oiled, shirts and aprons crisply white, fussed with gleaming, gurgling apparatus. At the table next to her, two elderly men in flat caps were debating something in the back pages of a newspaper. Beyond them, a middle-aged woman worked on her fingernails while she waited for her coffee to cool. Her white gloves lay crossed on the table before her. Skelsgård returned with their drinks.
"Getting any easier?"
"No."
But Auger took the coffee and cradled the hot metal mug in her hands. She kept her voice low, the two of them continuing to speak English.
"Skelsgård, I need to know something. How much of this is definitely real?"
"We've been over that."
"No, we haven't. You talk as if it's all real.
It feels real enough. But do we really know for sure?
What's brought this on? The sensor?"
"Yes,"
Auger said. "When we came through that screen, we lost any continuity with the real world. You treated it as if we were just passing through a curtain. But what if there was more to it than that? What if reality ended on the other side of the sensor? And all this, everything we see around us, is exactly what you just assured me it isn't, a kind of simulation.
Why does it matter?"
The question was not glib as it seemed. Skelsgård was watching her very carefully.
"If this is a simulation, then nothing we do inside here can have any possible consequence for the outside world. This whole city, this whole world, for that matter, might only be a representation inside some alien computer.
Quite the computer, if that's the case.
But it would still mean that these people..."
Auger lowered her voice even more.
"These people wouldn't be people. They'd just be interacting elements of some super complex program. It wouldn't matter what happened to them, because they're just puppets."
"Do you feel like a puppet?"
"How I feel is irrelevant. I've entered the program from the outside. What I don't see is how you can be so certain we're inside an ALS and not a computer-generated environment of some kind. I told you we pushed a pneumatic air hose through the sensor. That proves nothing. If the simulation is good, then it would have handled that detail as well."
Auger sipped at her coffee, flinching at the bitter taste of it before deciding that it wasn't the worst she'd ever drunk.
"All I'm asking is whether you've considered this possibility."
Skelsgård stirred too much sugar into her coffee.
"Of course we've considered it, but the hard truth is that we can't know for sure. Not yet, and maybe not ever."
"I don't follow. If this is a computer-generated environment, then it must have limitations."
"You're thinking way too parochially, Auger. This environment doesn't have to have any limits at all.
What about physics?"
Auger picked up one of the cardboard coasters that was strewn on the table and held it between thumb and forefinger.
"This feels real to me. But if I looked at it in a scanning, tunneling microscope or ran it through a mass spectrometer, what would I find?"
"Exactly what you'd expect, I guess. It would look just the way it should. Because this environment is simulated right down to atomic granularity?" No, Skalskard said. Not necessarily. But if the machine running the environment is sufficiently clever, it can make your microscope or your spectrometer show you whatever it thinks you expect. Remember, any tools you might bring to bear on the problem are themselves part of the problem.
Auger sat back in her seat. I hadn't thought of that.
It's pretty much academic anyway. There aren't any scanning tunneling microscopes just lying around here waiting to be picked up.
Then you've not performed such tests.
We've done what we can, given the very limited tools we've been able to put our hands on. And none of these tests have revealed anything other than the physics we'd expect. But just because you can't get your hands on those tools doesn't mean they don't exist somewhere.
Break into physics laboratories, you mean?
No, nothing that drastic. Just monitor their publications. This is the 20th century, Skalskard. It's the century of Einstein and Heisenberg. Those men can't be sleeping on the job, surely.
Well, there's a problem with that. Fundamental science is nowhere near as advanced here as it was in our 1959. Remember, I told you there was no Second World War here, and therefore no computer revolution?
Yes. Well, it had even greater effects than that. There was no Manhattan Project either. No one has the A-bomb here. Without the A-bomb, there's been no need to develop a ballistic missile program. Without a ballistic missile program, there's no space race. There are no huge government-funded science agencies. But surely there's still some scientific research and development going on. In dribs and drabs. But it's unfocused, underfunded, socially unpopular.
Auger managed a half-smile.
No change there, then.
What I mean is, it's almost as if...
But something made Skalskard stop and shrug.
Almost as if what? Auger prompted.
Well, I was going to say, it's almost as if someone's holding it back deliberately.
Who would stand to benefit from that?
Well, Skalskard said, at a guess, anyone who didn't want the people here to know what their world was really like.
13. Floyd crunched the Mathis' tires against the pavement outside Blanchard's building on Rue des Peupliers. Floyd and Christine had made an early start after breakfast, and although Floyd's head was ringing like a cracked bell, too much wine, too much music, with it came a kind of fragile alertness. His throat was raw from talking over the noise in Le Perroquet Pourpre, compounded by all the coffee he had pushed down it since waking.
"Go easy on Blanchard," Floyd said as he let Christine out of the car, toolkit in hand. "I don't want you even a hint that we suspect he may have done it."
"I suspect nothing,"
Christine said. "I merely wish to close off that particular possibility.
Make sure you don't close off the case while you're at it.
Trust me, Floyd, when it comes to these matters, I have at least as much experience as you. Have you remembered anything else about that typewriter in the quay? I can still see that cell. Beyond that, nothing. But I'm sure it will come to me."
Floyd drove back to the office. The elevator was working, for now at least. He rode the grinding, groaning box to the third floor and let himself into his rooms. He poured a cup of tepid coffee, then picked up the telephone and made another attempt to call the number in Berlin. Same result. The line was still dead. The operator couldn't tell him whether the number was incorrect or if the telephone at the other end had simply been disconnected. He fingered the letter from Caspar Metals, unwilling to throw away what seemed like the strongest lead in the case. While the telephone was still hot, he thumbed through his directory until he found the number of an old contact in Port-Danière. Formerly a skilled metal worker, he had been laid off from the Citroën factory after an industrial accident, and now worked from home. Although not a musician himself, he made a modest living by repairing brass instruments. The man picked up on the seventh ring.
"Basso. It's Floyd. How are you doing?"
"Wendell! What a pleasant surprise. Do you have something for me to look at? A trombone someone sat on?"
"Not today," Floyd said. "Christine and I haven't been getting out enough to mistreat our instruments. I was hoping that you could answer a couple of questions for me."
"About repairing instruments?"
"About metalworking.
Something's come up in the case we're working at the moment, and I don't know what to make of it."
He heard Basso settle into his chair.
"Tell me. I've got something that looks like a sketch made from a blueprint, and a letter related to a contract with a Berlin metalworks.
What I can't figure out is what the contract is for. Do you have anything to go on? It looks like the main work was the casting of three big spheres of solid aluminium.
Big spheres, Basso said ruminatively. How big, exactly?
3, maybe 3.5 meters across, if I'm reading the sketch properly.
Big indeed, he concurred.
You have any idea what that might be?
I'd need to look at the sketch, Wendell. Then I might be able to tell you something. Did you say solid aluminium?
I think so.
I wondered for a moment whether they might be bells.
Can you bring the sketch over, Wendell?
I might be more used to you in person.
This morning?
No time like the present.
Floyd agreed and put down the telephone. 5 minutes later, he was on his way to the 17th, with Costine's saxophone in the passenger seat next to him. By the time Auger and Skelsgård left the café on Saint-Germain, the sky had brightened. There was more traffic about, more windows open, more pedestrians on the streets. The city was coming awake.
Look at it this way, Skelsgård said. We have no evidence to suspect that this is a simulation, at least while science here is still stuck in the 1930s. But there's another angle.
And what's that?
We assume everything we see is real, made out of something more or less like normal matter. Maybe someone, some entity, created this place as a kind of snapshot, a backup copy of the real Earth. By intention or otherwise, the backup copy is running forward in time, progressing away from the instant when it was created. Therefore, this is an actual planet, populated by real people. Physics works flawlessly. The only thing that isn't real is the sky.
Because we're inside an ALS sphere.
Exactly.
And whatever other functions that sphere has to serve, the one thing it presumably must do is provide a convincing backdrop for the world it contains.
The sun had begun to edge over the rooftops on the other side of the Seine.
Then what's that? Auger said.
A fake sun. A source of light and heat. Nothing more. We know there's no room for a real sun inside an ALS. Not if you're going to squeeze a planet in there as well. So whatever that is, it must be painted onto the inner surface of the sphere.
It looks real to me.
Of course, but you're stuck on the surface of this planet with a fixed point of view, as is everyone else here.
What about the moon? Is that real?
We don't know. It looks real enough, and the slasher intelligence suggests that some of the worlds inside ALS objects have their own moons. But without being able to get out there and check, it could be made of green cheese, for all we know. Whatever the case, something raises lunar tides, and something takes care of the solar component as well. They've certainly covered the obvious details.
They'd have to maintain the illusion.
Absolutely.
So what about the non-obvious ones?
That's where astronomy comes in. Thing is, Auger, given the inevitable limitations, it would be pretty difficult to maintain this illusion forever. They can fake the sun and the moon and the stars in the night sky. They can even fake parallactic movements of the stars to make it seem as if the Earth is orbiting the sun. They can fake eclipses and a whole lot more, but there has to be a limit. The shell might be able to withstand scrutiny from the kind of astronomy they have here, but there is no radio astronomy here, no space-based astronomy. If any of those technologies came along, I doubt that the illusion could be sustained for very long.
But we had radio astronomy by now.
Another byproduct of the Second World War. We also had space-based astronomy, not to mention interplanetary space probes, within a decade or so. Any of those things would be the clincher, Auger.
What would happen if the people living here discovered the illusion?
Anyone's guess. The news might cause society to unravel overnight, or it might spur on a technological revolution, enabling them to develop the tools necessary to break through the sphere. If that were to happen, I doubt that it would take them more than a generation or two.
They might even overtake us, Auger said.
That too. The point is, within a relatively short period of time, they may have the means to test the accuracy of the ALS. If they find an error, some detail that doesn't make sense, then we'll know for sure that it isn't a simulation, because a simulation could be as perfect as its builders wished. We'll also know, finally, that this isn't a real past. The real 1959.
Auger looked at her companion.
As if that was ever likely. The maps already tell us that this isn't any slice of history from our own past.
But we can't be absolutely sure of that,
Skarsgård said. You're making a judgment based on your own historical knowledge and concluding that the maps don't fit into it.
I guess so, Auger allowed.
But your knowledge is a construct stitched together from the wreckage left behind by the nanocorst. It's incomplete and quite possibly wrong in key details.
Innocent mistakes.
Maybe, but it could be more than that.
It would have been the ideal time for someone to doctor the records, to change our view of the past to suit their own needs.
Which sounds suspiciously like paranoid conspiracy mongering to me.
All I'm saying is that whenever we make any judgments about the nature of the 1959 timeline here, we have to keep in mind that our own historical knowledge is incomplete and possibly flawed.
All the same, you don't seriously believe that you've actually opened a window into the past, do you?
It was an issue, Skarsgård said. A serious one, too, because the one thing we didn't want to do was screw around with our own timeline. That was why we brought your predecessor onto the team.
Susan.
Her job was to sift the evidence, to roam around the environment, measuring it against our historical knowledge. In the end, she found a number of instances where this version of Paris flatly contradicts what we have excavated on E1. For instance, structures that had been demolished here, but which still existed at the time of the nanocorst. Susan's preliminary conclusion, whatever this place is, it isn't a window into our past.
I'm glad you sorted that out.
Susan was supposed to tie together all the evidence and make a definitive report, but then she got sidetracked.
And killed, Auger said darkly.
Yes.
Auger slowed her footsteps. This box full of papers I'm supposed to find, do you think it relates to what you've just been talking about?
Until we see what's in it, we don't know.
It seems to me, Auger said, that Susan would have made her mind up pretty quickly about this timeline. It wouldn't have taken her long to figure out this wasn't our 1959. So what else was she interested in?
Susan kept digging, Skarsgård said. It wasn't enough for her just to hand in that report and not want to know more about what had happened here. She wanted answers to her questions. She wanted to know who made this place and why. She wanted to discover the precise moment at which it diverged from our history, and she wanted to know why that happened as well. Was it a chaotic accumulation of small changes, a snowballing butterfly effect? Or did some single deliberate act of intervention change history? And if so, who was responsible for that? And if someone did that, are they still working behind the scenes influencing things?
Which brings us back to your theory about arrested development.
The thing is, Auger, if someone is working behind the scenes, for whatever reason, they probably wouldn't have taken too kindly to Susan digging around the way she did.
She was an archaeologist, Auger said. Digging is what we do.
Can't argue with that, Skarsgård said.
They boarded a train at Saint-Germain-des-Prés and took the number 4 line to Montparnasse Bienvenue, then changed onto the elevated number 6 line, taking it west across the rooftops to Duplessis. The train was full of people on their way to work, strap hanging in long grey raincoats, heads buried in the morning editions. Nobody paid much attention to the view through the windows, but it was all Auger could do to stop herself gasping in wonder at the panorama of the city sliding by outside, meticulous in every detail. It was both exactly as she had imagined it would be, and nothing at all like she had expected. The old photographs could only convey so much. There was an entire human texture that simply hadn't registered, like the absence of color in a monochrome print. Everywhere she looked in the angled, intersecting streets, she saw people going about their business, and it was both marvelous and chilling to think of them having their own lives, their own dreams and regrets, knowing nothing of what they really were. Auger felt a shaming, voyeuristic thrill and snapped her attention away as soon as anyone was in danger of meeting her gaze. At Duplessis, they left the train, descending a latticed iron staircase to street level. They walked down de l'Hormel until it intersected with Emile Zola, and then walked a short way along Zola until they reached a pale stone 5-story establishment that identified itself as the Hôtel Royal.
You're booked in here for 3 days, Skarsgård said, as they walked into the carpet-lined lobby, but chances are you'll be out a lot sooner than that. If you need to stay longer, you have more than enough cash to cover your expenses.
Behind the lobby counter, The concierge was busy signing in a couple who must have arrived on an overnight train. They were flustered and appeared to be disputing some detail of their booking.
"Promise me one thing," Auger said.
"I don't do promises, but let's hear it. If this works out, if I get your precious box of papers back into safe hands, then let me have some time here alone."
"I don't know about that.
I'm already here, Moria. What harm can it do?
Aveling won't like it.
Aveling can shove it where the sun doesn't shine. The least he can give me is some time to play tourist. He'll say the deal was no tribunal, nothing more."
The couple moved away from the desk to the waiting elevator, and the concierge beckoned Auger and Skelskard forward. Auger shifted mental gears, forcing herself to speak French. The words emerged with surprising fluidity, as if some stiff part of her mind had suddenly been tuned and lubricated.
"My name is Auger," she said. "I have a reservation for the next 3 nights."
"Certainly, madame." The concierge glanced at Auger, then Skelskard, then back to Auger.
"Your bags have already arrived. How was your journey?"
"Fine, thank you."
He handed her the room key. "Number 27. I will have your luggage sent up in a moment."
"Is there a telephone in the room?"
"Of course, madame. We are a modern establishment."
She took the key and turned back to Skelskard.
"Guess I'm on my own now."
"You have the telephone number of the safe house near the station. One of us will be there around the clock. Call to keep us updated on what happens over the next few days. We'll need to arrange downtime when you return to the tunnel."
"Somehow I think I'll remember.
And go easy with Blanchard. If he doesn't hand over the goods on the first try, don't turn up the pressure. We don't want him getting wind that they're more valuable than they appear, or he may do something rash."
"I'll do my best."
"I know you will, Auger."
Skelskard leaned in and gave her a quick sisterly hug.
"Take care, all right?"
"Whatever happens," Auger said, "I'll be glad I've seen this much.
I'll see what I can swing with Eveling about getting you some tourist time. No promises, okay?"
"No promises."
Behind Auger, the elevator chimed open. The telephone was an antique, but she had handled examples like it in the museum section back home, lovingly restored and wired into a simple telephonic network. She entered the Paris number a digit at a time, waiting for the pleasant whir as the clockwork dial spun sedately back around to its starting position. Slow, but calming. Even in the entering of a number, there was time for reflection. The task could be safely abandoned before completion. A well-bred slasher, used to near-instantaneous communication, would have regarded the rotary telephone as not much of an improvement over semaphore. To a thresher, by contrast, there was something deeply reassuring and trustworthy about any kind of electromechanical hardware. It couldn't lie or distort the information it carried. It couldn't invade the mind or the flesh. At the far end of the line, a similar telephone rang. Auger felt an impulse to hang up before Blanchard responded, convinced that she wasn't ready to go through with this. Her palm was slippery on the handset, but she forced herself to stay on the line, and after another few moments someone answered. An old man's voice said, "Blanchard."
"Good morning, monsieur," she replied in French. "My name is Verity Auger. I'm not sure if you know my name, but..."
"Verity? As in the sister of Mademoiselle Suzanne White?"
"Yes," she said. "I'm calling about..."
Out of courtesy, or some misguided need to demonstrate his own skill, he shifted to English. His native French accent was obvious, but his speech was perfectly comprehensible.
"Miss Auger, I'm not sure if you have heard the news. If not, then perhaps..."
"It's all right, sir," she interrupted, also switching to English. "I know what happened to my sister."
She heard an intake of breath, relief, perhaps, that he didn't have to break that particular piece of news to her.
"I am very, very sorry about what happened to her. I was fortunate to know your sister quite well. She was a very nice young woman."
"Susan spoke well of you, sir.
It's obvious that she thought of you as someone she could trust."
"You speak of her belongings?"
"Yes,"
Auger replied, glad that he had raised the subject without prodding.
"I understand that my sister left some items..."
"It's not much,"
he said quickly, as if she might be expecting the crown jewels.
"I never expected it to be, sir. All the same, whatever she left still has value to us. To her family, I mean."
"Of course. Might I ask where you are calling from, Miss Auger?"
Paris, sir. A hotel in the 15th.
Then you are really not very far away. You can take the number 6 line to Place d'Italie, and then walk the remaining distance. Shall we make an appointment?
She knew she mustn't sound too surprised that he had agreed to hand over the box so easily.
Any time you like, sir. At the moment, the box is not in my possession. I gave it to a private detective who is investigating the circumstances surrounding Suzanne's death.
Circumstances, sir?
The possibility that it may not have been accidental, he elaborated.
Olga's hand tightened on the phone. At no point in her briefing had anyone mentioned a private detective snooping around. It had to be a new development, something Evelyn and the others didn't know about. Already she was off script.
It's really kind of you to take an interest, sir. This detective.
Oh, don't worry about him. I'm quite sure he's had time to examine Suzanne's things thoroughly by now.
Then when would be... An associate of the detective is here now. I can speak to him and arrange for the items to be back in my possession by... Shall we say by the end of the afternoon?
The end of the afternoon?
Today, sir. Is that a problem?
Not at all, sir. Not in the least. Her heart was thudding in her chest.
Let me have the name of your hotel and the telephone number. We shall say 4 o'clock in number 23 Rue des Peupliers, unless you hear from me. If you press the buzzer by my name, I shall let you into the building. My rooms are on the 3rd floor.
That's perfect, sir.
I very much look forward to making your acquaintance, Miss Auger.
And I look forward to meeting you, sir, she replied.
Basso opened the door to his tiny flat in Porte d'Anières, sniffing the air like a bloodhound.
Wendell, he said, I didn't think you'd remember the way. Is that a patient you have with you?
Floyd offered the saxophone case. She probably needs a little attention.
I thought you said you had nothing that needed repairing.
I did, Floyd said, but I'm sure you can find something wrong with it. Basso took the case and placed it down on the table next to his umbrella stand.
You're too kind. I am sure that the saxophone is in excellent health, but I never turn down a patient.
He peered over Floyd's shoulder.
Are you still driving that old relic?
It's difficult to fit a double bass into anything smaller. Basso shook his head amusedly.
You'll still be saying the same thing when that car's 40 years old. Now come in and have some tea.
Floyd removed his fedora. Actually, I could really use some coffee. As strong as you can manage.
Like that, is it?
Basso ushered Floyd into his dark living room. An unfeasible number of clocks ticked and whirred to themselves, some mounted on the walls, others perched on shelves and on the long granite mantelpiece. Supporting himself with a stick, Basso shuffled to one of the clocks, swung open its case, and made some tiny adjustment with a tool he carried in his pocket.
I was thinking about what you said about the spheres, Floyd said. Being bells, I mean.
Basso wandered into his kitchen and raised his voice.
What about them?
I don't see how they could be. I've never heard of a completely round bell. How would it chime?
I didn't mean that kind of bell, you buffoon. I meant diving bells, the kind you climb into. The size seemed about right.
But they're solid. After a while, Basso came back in with a single cup of coffee. It had the stiff black consistency of marine fuel oil, just a ticket as far as Floyd was concerned.
When you said solid, I didn't think you meant solid all the way through. I assumed you meant that the shells were to be formed from solid metal with no perforations or joints.
I'm pretty sure they're solid spheres.
Let me see the sketch.
Floyd passed him the paper and sat quietly ingesting the coffee, while Basso turned the paper this way and that, squinting and frowning. A few seconds before 11, there came a series of near-simultaneous clicks and ratcheting sounds from the clocks, as of mechanisms gearing up, and precisely on the hour the assembled clocks emitted a cacophony of chimes that lasted the better part of a minute. During this time, Basso continued studying the sheet of paper as if nothing was happening. When the clocks had settled down again, he lifted his face towards Floyd and said,
Well, you're right. It is solid, and it does seem to be about the size you mentioned.
With a blunt forefinger, he traced the other faint lines marked on the paper.
This seems to be some kind of support arrangement to suspend the sphere. Why the fine cables, I wonder?
His finger moved again.
This seems to be a kind of cross-section through a vat or tub. At a guess, I suspect that the sphere is supposed to be immersed in whatever goes into this tub.
Ring any bells? Other than the submarine kind, I mean.
I'm afraid I've never seen anything like this. Do you have any other information?
Floyd offered him the letter from Berlin.
Just this. It clearly refers to the same contract,
Basso said, reading down the paper, his lips moving softly as he mouthed the German.
Three spheres, copper-aluminium alloy with very high machining tolerances. Here's something about the support mechanism. Acoustic dampening, if I'm not misreading it.
What does that mean?
It's an arrangement designed to cut down on the transmission of vibrations.
And how would it work?
That would depend on the application. If the sphere was the source of the vibrations, like the engine in a submarine, then it might need to be cushioned, so that those vibrations didn't escape out through the hull and into the surrounding water, where they could be picked up by enemy sonar.
It doesn't look like any kind of marine engine to me, Floyd said.
No, it doesn't. Which raises the other possibility, which is that the sphere is the thing that has to be protected from vibrations.
What sort of thing are you thinking of?
It could be almost anything, Basso said. Any kind of sensitive scientific or commercial apparatus might benefit from that kind of protection.
Guess that narrows it down slightly, Floyd said. For a while back there, we wondered if it might be some kind of bomb.
No, I don't think that's what it is. The apparent solidity, he mused, ticking off key points on his fingers. The very precise machining specifications. The need for dampening. They all point to it being some kind of measurement apparatus. What kind? I couldn't begin to imagine.
Basso returned the paper to Floyd.
Of course, I could be completely wrong.
But you might be on the right track. Floyd finished the thick black coffee. It was like pouring hot asphalt down his throat.
Thanks, Basso. You've been helpful. Although it probably wasn't worth your driving all the way over here to see me.
That's all right, Floyd said. I had to bring the patient with me, didn't I?
Basso rubbed his hands. Let's have a look at her, shall we?
Floyd stopped on the way home to pick up provisions and have a leisurely lunch at a cafe near the Trocadero. By 2, he was back at his desk, pulling out his notebook and thumbing through to Blanchard's number. It was much earlier than the time he had arranged to call Custine, but he was anxious to know if there had been any progress with the wireless set. Floyd let the telephone ring for half a minute, hung up and then waited a minute or two before trying again, with no success. He concluded that Blanchard must have been elsewhere, perhaps upstairs in Susan White's room, if he hadn't left the building entirely. He tried once more 5 minutes later, but still there was no answer. Floyd was placing the receiver back on its cradle when he noticed something that had been pushed beneath the squat black pedestal of the telephone. It was a sheet of folded paper, and it had not been there that morning. He pulled it out and opened it up. He recognized a block of text in Custine's very neat curlicued handwriting. The message read,
Dear Floyd, I hope and pray that you find this letter in good time. I could have placed it openly on your desk, or even in your pigeonhole, but for reasons that will shortly become apparent, I believe this would have been a very unwise course of action. I have just returned by taxi from Rue des Peupliers. I find myself in a great deal of trouble. I must not say too much, for the less you know about it, the less chance there will be of my friends from the cave finding some way of connecting it to you. In any case, I am sure they will be in touch with you soon. In the meantime, I must make myself scarce. I do not think it is safe for me to remain in Paris for very much longer. I will try to make contact, but for both our sakes, I suggest you make no effort to find me. Now destroy this message, and then take very good care of yourself. Your friend and colleague, A.C. P.S. I do not think Eimsoth and Reinke make typewriters.
Floyd sat, stunned. He reread the message, hoping that he had been hallucinating, but nothing about the letter had changed. Something had happened, and now Custine was on the run. He felt as if he needed a drink. He picked up the bottle to pour himself a finger of brandy, but then returned it to the table unopened. What he really needed, some quiet, detached voice told him, was utter clarity of mind, and he needed it fast. The case had been progressing smoothly.
They were onto something big. He'd become increasingly sure of that. But nothing had prepared him for this sudden, savage turn of events. What could possibly have happened? He replayed the sequence of events in his mind, thinking about Custine's intentions for the day. Everything had been normal when he left Custine at Blanchard's building earlier that morning, complete with his tools. The big man had planned to have another listen to the wireless, to see if those Morse signals came through again. He'd also intended to quiz the missing tenant on the second floor, and to nibble around the delicate matter that Blanchard might have had something to do with the murder. There was scope for the old man to have taken offense if Custine had barged in with a tactless line of questioning, but that was the last thing Custine would have done. His experience in the Quai had made him much better at that tact and diplomacy stuff than Floyd. So what the hell had happened? Floyd's hands were trembling. "Get a grip," he told himself sternly. What Custine needed now was for Floyd to stay in control. The way to stop himself collapsing into a bundle of nerves was to act, to keep moving. His first instinct was to drive to Rue des Peupliers, but it hadn't been his plan to go there until later in the afternoon. The one thing he didn't want to do was anything that might suggest he'd received a communication from Custine. But there had been no answer when he telephoned Blanchard. Perhaps that would have prompted him to fire up the Mathis and drive across town, even if he hadn't seen the letter on his desk, or perhaps it would never have crossed his mind that there was a problem. "Do something," he told himself. He reread the letter. No clue as to Custine's current whereabouts, so no need for Floyd to bluff about that if anyone asked him, although he had a suspicion. He put it out of his mind. It would be safer for both of them if he didn't even speculate about where Custine might be holed up. He read it again, forcing his hands to still themselves. The reference to the typewriter. What was that about? Had something finally jogged Custine's memory? Do something. Floyd went to a shelf and pulled down a commercial directory for the Paris area. He flipped through until he reached the H section and then ran his finger down the page until he found the entry for the Paris office of Heimsoth and Reinke, more than a little surprised to discover that the firm even existed. Quickly, he dialed the number. "Heimsoth and Reinke," said an efficient female voice. "May I help you? I have an electric typewriter that needs repairing. Can you tell me if there is a location in the Paris area that deals with that sort of thing?" "A typewriter?" she asked, sounding surprised, Floyd thought. "It's a Heimsoth and Reinke model. I found it amongst the items I inherited when my aunt passed away. It doesn't seem to work, but it looked rather expensive, and so I imagined it might be worth having it fixed to sell on." "There must be some mistake. This firm doesn't make typewriters, and it certainly doesn't repair them."
"But the box the typewriter's in says..."
He could hear the woman's patience wearing thin.
"Heimsoth and Reinke make enciphering equipment, not typewriters. Our most popular model is the Enigma, which might conceivably be mistaken for a typewriter."
The tone of her voice told him that only the very ignorant could possibly have made this mistake. Floyd asked, "What would my aunt have been doing with an enciphering machine? I thought such things were meant for spies and soldiers."
"That's a common misconception. Over the last 30 years, we've sold many thousands of Enigma machines to various parties, including banks and businesses that wish to protect their commercial interests. Of course, the military models are more complicated, but there's no law that says an individual can't own an Enigma machine. Are you still interested in having it repaired, assuming that it is indeed broken?"
"I'll think about it," Floyd said. "In the meantime, thank you for your assistance." As Floyd placed the receiver back on its cradle, there was a knock at the door. But the timbre of the sound was wrong somehow, as if someone was already inside the apartment. Floyd had no sooner arrived at this conclusion when he observed 3 pairs of polished shoes approaching him across the floor of the adjoining room. He looked up, taking in 2 uniformed officers of the Quai and a 3rd man, alarmingly young and sleek, who was dressed in the long raincoat and heavy serge suit of a plainclothesman. The uniformed officers retained their hats, but the plainclothes inspector had already removed his bowler.
"Can I help you?" Floyd started.
The plainclothes man spoke as the 3 of them entered the main office.
"I'm so very glad to find you at work, Monsieur Floyd. I heard you on the telephone. I hope we aren't interrupting anything important."